So as I told you all earlier, my name is Jawan Hall, and in addition to emceeing this event, I was asked to speak briefly on a view from the youth. And so while I know I don't speak for all youth, I'm going to do my best to kind of speak across the youth spectrum. I first want to acknowledge the students from Indigo Nation Homeschool Association and Kwame Nkrumah Academy. Please give it up for them. Y'all can have a seat. We appreciate you all being here. And so, yeah, just myself, I'm currently a law student at John Marshall. One of the reasons that I wanted to pursue a legal education is because I truly believe in this cause for reparations, and I know we need warriors on all fronts fighting. So whether that be business folks, legal professionals, activists, students, and regular ordinary day folks who truly just care about this issue. Let us never forget that the masses of us today are descendants of stolen African people. We were dehumanized, had our culture and history distorted and appropriated. We supposedly fought a series of wars in defense of freedom and liberty, to include a civil war, a couple of world wars, and a series of international military campaigns that range from small-scale tactical exercises to operations that scale across nations around the world, all in the names of freedom and justice that we have yet to see today. And all of that, through all of that, we're still here, hindered by the harms of our past, but still able to build a better tomorrow. We're gathered here today and right now to address these very issues and collectively continue the work through a path forward. This gathering today is one of living legends. Each and every one of you in here has the power to help move our cause forward. And we're only limited by our imagination and our willingness to actualize our dreams. We are living our history, and we have the ability to shape what our future looks like. There is no end-all, be-all to what we can do to continue to be a part of this work. And we must use every tool available, including voting, organizing, building, and investing in our institutions, whether they be civic, political, spiritual, or educational, continuing to educate and support each other, empowering each other through our everyday interactions. And from the conversations that I've had with many of you in this audience and through my own faith and belief in humanity, I believe that we will see reparations in our lifetime. And with that, my ask of all of you is to open up your ears to the elders who are about to come up, Dr. Worrell and Dr. Darity, as they offer up research and insights into this issue that we all must collectively continue to push forward on. And with that, Dr. Conrad Worrell, please come up and give a view from the elders.
How's everybody?
Good.
So, I'm 77 years old. And I formally joined the reparations movement in 1964. And so, a part of what Cam asked me to do today is what the question is, how can we revive the reparation movement in America? And if we take a little throwback in history, in 1996, in the San Jose Mercury News, there was a three-part series by a white journalist by the name of Gary Webb, where he had documented how the United States government was in collusion with street organizations to disseminate crack cocaine in the United States, and those profits being used to finance the Contras and Nicaragua. Y'all remember that?
Yeah.
So the organization that I was the national chair of at that time, the National Black United Front, decided that we would try to replicate the genocide campaign that Paul Robeson, W. Du Bois, and William Patterson had launched in 1951. And so we launched the campaign in October of 1996, focusing in on this crack cocaine proliferation in the African community, and began to create a petition to replicate the organizing that was taking place across the country. And in May of 1997, we went to the United Nations to charge the United States government with genocide.
All right.
on Malcolm's birthday, May 19, 1997. Now, I'm telling you this because this was a period in our history that we were beginning to gain mass momentum around the reparations movement and working with NCOBRA and other groups throughout the United States. And so when we got back, five of us went to Geneva, Switzerland, and there's a process to charge the United States or any country that wants to charge another country with genocide. There's a process. It's called a 1503 procedure. And you have to formally write a complaint and fill out all this paperwork at the United Nations. And it's a confidential process, and you really don't know what's going to happen. But when we got back to Chicago, I got a document from the State Department saying that the United States government had received our complaint. And in June of 1997, you may have remembered, the President Clinton gave a speech at San Diego State University on the question of race. And created out of that speech, he called for a race commission and appointed John Hope Franklin as the chair. Y'all remember some of that?
Some of that, yes, sir.
It just so happened John Hope Franklin's family were victims of Black Wall Street in Tulsa in 1921.
That's right.
And so John Hope Franklin, inside this commission, began raising the question of reparations, particularly as it related to Tulsa. The reason I'm giving you this background, because it was in that period, a few years later, a book came out, The Debt, by Randall Robinson.
That's right.
And we were beginning to gain momentum, and we began to find out in 1997 that the United Nations was going to have a world conference against racism. Mm-hmm. And so our organization, the National Black United Front, hooked up with the December 12th movement out of Brooklyn, New York, and created a strategy, and we went to NCOBRA and other groups working in the reparations movement in this country and around the world to establish a strategy to go to the UN World Conference Against Racism, in which 165 nations in the world, 15,000 people in a non-governmental component of the conference and the governmental side, to create a specific strategy to charge, to say that the transatlantic slave trade, slavery and colonialism were crimes against humanity, and that African people worldwide were owed reparations.
That's right.
Now, y'all remember that?
Yeah.
Now, I'm only saying this because that was in that period.
Right.
But in 1915, the Chicago Defender wrote a story about Callie House and her file against the United States government for reparations coming out of her work in the 1890s into the 20th century and her leadership in the National Ex-Slave Bounty and Pension Association.
That's right.
And they filed a lawsuit in federal court in Washington, D.C. that the Chicago Defender reported for $68 million.
That's right.
So the work of the reparations movement emerged after the sellout of 40 Acres Mule and Andrew Johnson, after Abraham Lincoln passed, changed the formula, and the 800,000 acres of land in the southeast portion of the United States that was supposed to be designated to the so-called enslaved African were now reverted to the Confederate soldiers.
Whoa.
And so after that period in our history, by the 1880s and 1890s, our people began to hear that some of the soldiers, white soldiers, were getting pensions for their participation in the Civil War.
Yes.
And so Callie House learned about this and hooked up with other organizers and created the National Ex-Slave Bounty and Pension Association that organized 600,000 black people who paid 25 cents a month, or I believe it was, and had a mass motion around the demand for pensions / reparations for African people. In 1915, they filed this lawsuit, this reparations lawsuit, and the government indicted Callie House for mail fraud and told her that she knew that the United States government would never give her what she was asking for, so she was defrauding her people. This is very important to understand this history of the reparations movement. And it wasn't Garvey who was the first person who was indicted on mail fraud. It was Callie Howe, and she served a year and a day in the federal penitentiary in Tennessee.
That's right.
And so the reparations movement has had its peaks and it's had its lows. And so let me just read to you this, because I could stand up here all day long and talk about the various phases and peaks and valleys of the reparations movement in this country. But this is what Malcolm said. If you are a son of a man who had a wealthy estate and you inherit your father's estate, you have to pay off the debts that your father incurred before he died. Malcolm was assassinated February 21st, 1965 in New York. So it's only fitting that we read this today. This is February 23rd. Malcolm said, the only reason that the present generation of white Americans are in a position of economic strength is because their fathers worked our father for over 400 years with no pay. We were sold from plantation to plantation like you sell a horse or a cow or a chicken or a bushel of wheat. All that money is what gives the present generation of American whites the ability to walk around the earth with their chest out like they have some kind of economic ingenuity. Your father isn't here to pay. My father isn't here to collect. But I'm here to collect, and you're here to pay. Malcolm X, November 23rd, 1964, Paris, France. So I really don't want to be up here too long and get carried away, because everybody knows me, knows I have a lot of documents. But let me read this letter that an ex-slave wrote to his master when his master was asking him to return home after the Civil War. And by the way, if you want to study our organizing work and the first mass reparations movement, you need the young people, particularly in this room, need to read the great book on Callie Howe by Mary Frances Berry, My Faith is Black is True, which is the history of the first mass reparations movement in America. But let's read this, because we got to get a handle on this. This reparations is not going to happen until we have a mass movement to sustain, until the masses of our people catch on to this idea, just as we caught on in the civil rights movement to the eradication of racial segregation under the law, and we were united around that movement.
Right.
Our challenge today in organizing is to unite our people around the just demand for reparations and build a mass movement. That's when these politicians will move.
Right.
To my old master, Colonel P.H. Anderson, Big Spring, Tennessee. So I got your letter that was glad to find that you had not forgotten, Jordan, and that you wanted me to come back and live with you again, promising to do better for me than anybody else can. I have often felt uneasy about you. Now, this is 1865.
Yeah.
A letter from an ex-slave to his slave master, who was inviting him to come back. I thought the Yankees would have hung you long before this for harboring rebs they found at your house. I suppose they never heard about you going to Colonel Martin's to kill the Union soldiers that were left by his company in their stable. Although you shot at me twice before I left you, I did not want to hear of your being hurt, and I'm glad you are still living. it would do me good to go back to the dear old home again and see Miss Mary and Miss Martin and Alan, Esther and Green and Lee. Give my love to them all and tell them I hope we will meet in the better world, if not in this. I would have gone back to see you all when I was working in the Nashville Hospital, but one of the neighbors told me that Henry intended to shoot me if I ever got a chance. I want to know particularly what the good chance is you to propose to give to me. I am doing tolerably well here. I get $25 a month with victuals and clothing and have a comfortable home for Mandy. The folks call her Mrs. Anderson, and the children, Billy, Jane, and Grandy, go to school and are learning. We are likely treated. Sometimes we overhear others saying them colored people were slaves down in Tennessee. The children feel hurt when they hear such remark, but I tell them it was no disgrace in Tennessee to belong to Colonel Anderson. Many darkies would have been proud, as I used to be, to call you master. Now, if you write and say what wages you will give me, I will be better able to decide whether it would be to my advantage to move back. As to my freedom, which you say I can have, there's nothing to be gained on that score, as I got my free papers in 1864 from the Provost Marshal General of the Department of Nashville. Mandy says she would be afraid to go back without some proof that you were disposed to treat us justly and kindly. As we have concluded to test your sincerity by asking you to send us our wages for the time we served you. This will make us forget and forgive old scores and rely on your justice and friendship in the future. I served you faithfully for 32 years and Mandy 20 years. At $25 a month for me and $2 a week for Mandy, our earnings would amount to $11,680. Add this to interest for the time our wages have been kept back and deduct what you paid for our clothing and three doctor visits to me and pulling a tooth for Mandy, and the balance would show that we are in justice entitled to. Please send the money to Adams Express, care of B. Winters Esquire, Dayton, Ohio. If you fail to pay us for our faithful labor in the past, we can have little faith in your promises in the future. We trust the good maker has opened your eyes to the wrongs which you have and your fathers have done to me and my father in making us toil for generations without recompense. Surely there will be a day of reckoning for those who defraud the labor of his hire. In answering this letter, please state if there would be any safety for my Millie and Jane, who are now grown up and both good-looking girls. You know how it was with poor Matilda and Catherine. I would rather stay here and starve and die, if it come to that, than have my girls brought to shame by the violence and wickedness of their young masters. You will also please state if there have been any schools open for the colored children in your neighborhood. The great desire of my life now is to give my children an education and have them form virtuous habits. Say howdy to George Carter and thank him for taking the pistol from you when you were shooting at me. So the Garvey movement that went to the League of Nations to lobby to carve out territory in the eastern part of Africa, which was known as repatriation, to Queen Mother Moore in 1955, creating the Descendants of Africa organization with Dara Abubakara, to 1962, that Queen Mother Moore led a protest demanding reparations at the United Nations, to James Forman in 1969, who came out of Detroit at a Black Liberation Economics Conference, who created a strategy to demand that the white church give up $500 million, and went to Riverside Church and shut down a church service, and for 1 month marched around the United Church headquarters in New York to James Forman, to the Republic of New Africa,
come on now,
and its founding in 1968,
that's right,
who said that they wanted five states in the South as part of a reparations demand, to the spirit of Imari Obadeli, who worked with Chokwe Lumumba and Nkechi Taifa and others at a conference at Howard University that rolled out the idea of creating this coalition called the National Coalition for Reparations in America. I got to stop. Okay. You see what I mean? I'm sorry. But it is a long story. And if I could only make the final point, we have to organize. And we have to make reparations the single issue that black people in America unite on, just as we united on the dismantling of racial segregation, and make that the singular issue that we focus in on this country, and that's when it will go down.
All right.
All right, at this time, I want to introduce Dr. William Darity. Dr. Darity is a Samuel Du Bois Cook Professor of Public Policy at Duke University. He is a leading black economist in the nation, a leading authority on reparations, and a leading author of What We Got Wrong About Closing the Racial Wealth Gap. At this time, I would like you all to please join me in welcoming Dr. William Darity to the stage.
I'd like to begin by thanking Professor Harris for his generosity and for inviting me to come to this event, which is I think is a critical event. I'd also like to thank InCobra for their dedication, their passion, and their commitment to this issue over so many years. A friend of mine who has been long involved with InCobra is an attorney named Ajua Ayotoro, and I would like to recognize her in particular because of the kind of work that she's done on this issue. And I'd also like to acknowledge Professor Armstead Allen, who is an old friend and who had me come out to his conference at Olive Harvey College on at least two or three occasions. So I'm glad to be back in Chicago, and he's one of the people who has brought me to Chicago before. So I'd like to begin with a personal story that evolved in a conversation that I was having with Professor Harris yesterday. Professor Harris asked me if I'd always been in favor of reparations, and I had to say, honestly, no. And so I tried to reconstruct the point at which I developed a commitment to the reparations movement. And it turns out that there was an academic who was at the University of Pennsylvania whose name happened to be Richard F. America. Right? That's really his name. And actually, he uncovered a notice that was issued by a slave owner for his ancestor when his ancestor ran away. And that notice refers to his ancestor's last name as America. So this is kind of strange, but that's the story. So Richard America was preparing an edited volume that you can still obtain. It is called The Wealth of Races. And he came to me and he asked me if I would write the introduction to that volume. And I said to him, well, Richard, you know, reparations might be something that's morally right, but it's never going to happen. And Richard said, please read the papers for this volume, write an introduction, and you can say whatever you please. If you want to say that these papers are from Cloud Cuckoo Land, you can say that. but please write this introduction. So I started to examine the papers for this volume, several of which were attempts to construct estimates of the magnitude of reparations that were conducted by other economists. And as I kept reading these papers, I became increasingly convinced that this was so much the right thing to do that even if the odds were long, we should be in the process of trying to make it happen. So it's Richard America who's in some sense responsible for me moving in the direction of trying to think in a very comprehensive way about how we might construct a reparations program for Black Americans. I'd also like to add that about 7 years ago, a woman named Sean Hunter, who was at the time an editor at the University of North Carolina Press and is now the senior acquisitions editor at the University Press of Florida, heard a presentation that I gave on Black reparations and came up to me and urged me to write a book on the topic. So in 2008, I had jointly written an op-ed for The Root called The Big Payback, which I co-authored with my wife, Kirsten Mullen, and this helped us give us the confidence we needed to jointly pursue Sean Hunter's charge and bring such a project to completion. So in this immediately past December, we finally delivered the full manuscript to the University of North Carolina Press, and we anticipate that the book, titled From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century, will appear in February 2020. So thank you. Well, we all have to wait about a year, but it will be there. And it will be there before the election takes place. Okay. So it's our hope that this book will introduce several new and important dimensions to the reparations conversation. We advance a case in the book for reparations that are predicated not only upon the deep injustices of American slavery. In fact, as I mentioned to the group of folks I was talking to a little bit earlier, the smaller group, I flinch when I hear reference made narrowly to slavery reparations. Okay. Compensation due to Black Americans also must address the harms of the near century-long epoch of legal apartheid in the United States, the Jim Crow period, and ongoing discrimination, economic inequality, extrajudicial police killings, and mass incarceration. A suitable program of Black reparations must be directed at restitution for the grievous wrongs visited upon Blacks in America, both during the slavery years and after slavery ended. And a program of reparations should achieve three objectives: acknowledgement, redress, and closure. Acknowledgement, redress, and closure. So in a prelude to the extended discussion in our book, our article in The Root introduced each of these goals with the following description. Acknowledgement. Acknowledgement involves an apology for slavery, for legal segregation, and ongoing discrimination in housing, access to credit, employment, and the criminal justice system. Essentially, Congress would be admitting that while these institutions were legal, they were immoral and caused extensive damage that continues to the present day. Acknowledgement would lead to a rethinking of our history, a critical step in the healing process. Another observation I made in the discussion a bit earlier is that a particular dimension of our nation's history that has to be reconstructed and reconsidered is the way in which we view the Confederacy. I mean, this is fundamental, okay? And I said the Confederacy must be construed accurately as an act of traitorship, and that's fundamental, okay? Second, redress involves restitution, compensation to eliminate racial inequality. This could include options such as direct payments, vouchers for schooling or business startups, and the formation of trust funds to purchase stock shares for African Americans. It also could include the development and implementation of school curricula examining America's racial history and the creation of community-level institutions to promote sustained racial equality. And then the third thing, and this sometimes bothers folks, but I think we've got to make a commitment to this being the third arm of a reparations program, and this is closure. Closure involves mutual reconciliation between the beneficiaries of white supremacy and those who have been harmed by it. Whites and blacks would come to terms over the past, confront the present, and unite to create a new future. Once the reparations program is executed and racial inequality is eliminated, African Americans would make no further claims for race-specific policies on the American government unless there's a new wave of injustices. Okay? These three objectives are summarized by the acronym ARC, or ARC, suggestive of the famous phrase that Martin Luther King Jr. borrowed from the 19th century transcendentalist Theodore Parker. And you all probably are quite familiar with this phrase. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Yeah. Well, Kirsten and I believe that the arc of the moral universe must be propelled towards justice. Black reparations can drive the nation forcefully in the ethical direction. In addition, in our book, we are specific about the criteria for eligibility for reparations. To receive the benefits of the compensatory policy, an individual must demonstrate that they had an ancestor who was enslaved in the United States, and for at least 10 years before the adoption of the reparations program, that they self-identified on a legal document as black, African-American, Afro-American, colored, or Negro. I'll take any of them. So black reparations in the United States must be targeted to benefit, in the current parlance, ADOS, American descendants of slavery, who have a profound and longstanding claim for justice from the federal government. Now, I must say that we reject the judicial route to establishing reparations and insist upon congressional approval. This, of course, will require national political leaders to take up the cause of black reparations. It's noteworthy that one of the current presidential candidates, Marianne Williamson, has in fact endorsed reparations and proposed an amount. I think that the first and only presidential candidate to support black reparations until Williamson was Cynthia McKinney in 2008. Okay. Yeah. Now, the difficulty with Williamson's initial declaration of support for reparations is her recommendation for a program amounting to $100 billion. Now, apparently she arrived at this sum by seeking an amount similar to the $89 billion commitment made by the German government to victims of the Holocaust. But $100 billion is far too low, and it's not clear why the sum of money assigned to compensate victims of a genocidal horror that largely took place over the course of 5 years is relevant to the determination of the sum that should be assigned to compensate victims of 242 years of the damages of white supremacy, 242 since the founding of the American Republic. But even if we were to take the Holocaust payments as the basis for the magnitude of black reparations in the United States, $89 billion in 1952 is not equal to $100 billion in 2019. An adjustment must be made both for inflation and foregone money interest. So if I use a conservative 3% interest rate to generate a present value calculation, $89 billion in 1952, when the German program of reparations was approved, would approach $626 billion in 2019. At a 4% interest rate, the current value is $1.2 trillion. And at a 5% interest rate, the current value is $2.2 trillion. And this first figure is 10 times as great, and the second figure 20 times as great as $100 billion. Now, in the last chapter of our book, we supply procedures for calculating the size of the reparations bill tailored to the specific abuses inflicted on black Americans. We offer more plausible bases for determining the size of the social invoice than simply selecting the amount parallel to the magnitude of the Holocaust reparations payments. Now, there's a problem here. I can't divulge what's in that last chapter without having some severe problems with my co-author. So you all have to wait. In addition to offering procedures for gauging the magnitude of the bill, the final chapter of From Here to Equality sketches a potential structure for a reparations program. This encompasses discussion of multiple possible uses of a reparations fund, what we call a portfolio of reparations, that might include a fund to support retirement security, another to support entrepreneurial initiatives, another to support financing higher education, as well as a direct payment of a check to eligible recipients. Yeah. More and more Americans actually appreciate the moral case for black reparations. Polling estimates in 2016 indicated that 80% of white Americans oppose reparations for black Americans. But correspondingly, that means, looks like a very small number, but I'm going to show you why it isn't so small, 20% approve. Because in 2003, a study, that's 13 years ago, 13 years before the 2016 study, a study conducted by political scientists Michael Dawson and Ravana Popoff found that a minuscule 4% of white Americans expressed support for black reparations. So while the proportion remains low, the trend is strongly positive. And I think we need to seize upon this upward tide and move reparations from a dream to a reality. But in addition, I think we need to address the resistance to reparations within the black community. Acceptance of the premise that our economic inequality today is due to our own behavior constitutes a barrier, a severe obstacle to getting unified support for black reparations. And this arises out of what I'd like to call the trope of black dysfunction, which is so popular with so many members of our community, okay? And I'm going to try to talk about this in some detail. So let me begin with the opening text to closing the, what we get wrong about closing the racial wealth gap, to give you a sense of the magnitude of the wealth disparities, and then I'm going to talk about why we have these wealth disparities. Okay, so the racial gap is, racial wealth gap is large, and it shows no signs of closing. Data from the Survey of Income and Program Participation shows that black households hold less than 7 cents on the dollar compared to white households at the median, and that's 7 cents in wealth. The white household living near the poverty line typically has about $18,000 in wealth, while black households in similar economic conditions typically have a median wealth near zero. And I must emphasize that income and wealth are not the same things. They are not to be confused. Wealth is the difference between the value of what you own and what you owe, or the difference between your assets and your liabilities, or the net value of your property. And it is a store of resources that you can carry with you through time to draw upon. And it's particularly important to have it if you are confronted with an income emergency, such as a loss of a job or a major medical emergency in your family. The vast majority of black households don't have the capacity to meet any of those emergencies without trying to borrow. If you are a low-income household that's trying to borrow, you're going to have to borrow at predatory rates. Okay, this is why this is a big deal. In fact, many black families actually have a negative net worth. That is to say, the value of their debts exceeds the value of their assets. Now, at the other end of America's economic spectrum, black households constitute less than 2% of those in the top 1% of the nation's wealth distribution. White households constitute more than 96% of the wealthiest Americans. Moreover, even among the nation's wealthiest households, extreme differences persist on the basis of race. The 99th percentile black family is worth a mere $1.6 million. And I say it's a mere, you're going to see why I say it's a mere in a moment. While the 99th percentile white family is worth over $12 million. Wow. This means over 870,000 white families have a net worth above $12 million, while out of the 20 million black families in America, fewer than 380,000 are even worth a single $1 million. By comparison, over 13 million of the total 85 million white families are millionaires or better. Over 13 million of the total 85 million white families are millionaires or better. Blacks, while constituting just under 13% of the nation's population,
collectively own less than 3% of the nation's total wealth. So wealth is far more unequally distributed than income. And while income is primarily earned in the labor market, wealth is built primarily, and this is crucial, by the transfer of resources across generations, locking in the deep divides we observe across racial groups. So all of these other claims that I'm going to talk about that are made about why we have a racial wealth gap are largely incorrect and irrelevant. The central factor that determines what type of wealth individual households have and what shapes the racial wealth gap is the capacity of parents and grandparents to transfer large amounts of resources to the next generation. Okay? So I want to talk about some of these commonly held myths about the racial wealth gap. So the first one I want to talk about is the claim that the racial wealth gap is due to the fact that black folks just aren't educated. Okay. So if black folks got more education, then they'd have more wealth. Yeah. At the median, a black household head with a college degree has 2/3 of the net worth of a white household head who never finished high school.
Okay.
And in fact, and this is interesting, you can argue that blacks actually display more motivation for educational achievement and attainment than whites. A couple of studies that were conducted by the economist Patrick Mason and the sociologist William Mangino, separate studies, they demonstrate that for a given level of family income, blacks get more years of schooling and more credentials than whites. And so to the extent that whites have a higher level of education than blacks, it is entirely explained by the higher levels of income of those white families. Okay? Another claim is made, well, we would have more wealth if we worked harder and generated higher incomes. Well, it's interesting to note that blacks working full time have less net worth than whites or are unemployed. Okay? Here's another popular one. It's our disorganized families that cause our wealth to be so low. Now, I'm not going to get into the debate here over what constitutes family disorganization. What people are really talking about is the notion that there's a lot more single-parent families in the black community. Okay, it's true. But the median single-parent white family, has more than 2 times the wealth of two-parent black families.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is one that really annoys me when people throw it out. See, what's happening is the analysis is getting reversed. So the argument here is that people are making is that family disorganization leads to low wealth. But a more sensible causal path would be low wealth leads to greater family disorganization. I would love to see what the pattern of family formation looks like in the black community if we had the same levels of wealth as whites. Okay? Okay. Fourth argument is, well, you know, if black folks just knew how to manage their budgets, manage their funds, if they had some financial literacy, we'd close the racial wealth gap. Now remember, the racial wealth gap is enormous. I mean, the median black family has 7 cents to the dollar of the median wealth of a white family. Okay, so there actually is no evidence that blacks have less financial savvy than whites once you take into account wealth itself,
right. The
wealth of the families themselves. But also, financial literacy only can be useful if you have some finances to manage. So as an advocate of reparations, I certainly say we should structure a program in advance of receipt of reparations that I'd like to call pre-reparations preparation. Okay? And that could include financial literacy or financial management education. But then we'd have a reason for having greater financial literacy and financial education. So here's another one. This is what I call the bling factor argument. And this is the idea that black folks just spend too much on wasteful things. Okay? We don't save.
Okay.
So there actually is no evidence whatsoever that blacks save less than whites once household income is taken into account. There is no evidence that blacks saved less than whites. And in fact, in some income categories, the black savings rate is higher than the white rate. And a recent study using the Survey of Consumer Finances conducted by the Institute on Assets and Social Policy finds that at similar levels of income, whites spend 1.3 times as much as blacks. Wow. So, you know, maybe everybody's profligate, right? But black folks are no more profligate than anybody else. In fact, I had a student, Parfait Gassana, who did a study on what we call conspicuous consumption. That is, purchases of goods that people perceive as giving them status in the eyes of others. And he finds that all social groups engage in conspicuous consumption. He said, blacks and Latinos tend to do it by purchasing clothes and accessories. Whites do it by buying multiple cars. Okay. Now, the final myth I want to address, and it's the one I want to give the most comprehensive discussion today. Some of my compadres are kind of derisive about this myth, the ones who agree with me that it's incorrect, and they call this the Hotep position. That's a little bit ugly, but I'm going to let that go. But this is the notion that blacks can build an economic empire with our own existing resources if we just would work in solidarity and act with greater wisdom. Okay? And unfortunately, this is the big lie that underlies many fraudulent schemes and pipe dreams. Black America does not have the economic capacity to close the racial wealth gap via our own behavior. Okay? I'm going to throw that out. That's a strong statement. We cannot do it with our existing resources just by changing what we do as a community. Okay, so let me go into some depth about this one because I know this is the provocation. Okay, so I'm going to actually share some text with you from what we get wrong about closing the racial wealth gap. Okay. So in 1968, in his famous I've Been to the Mountaintop speech, he gave the I've Been to the Mountaintop speech more times than the night before he was assassinated. Okay, Martin Luther King Jr. called for a bank-in movement. To assert black independence, King called on his followers to strengthen black institutions by taking your money out of the banks downtown and deposit your money in Tri-State Bank, a black-owned bank. This idea that buying and banking from black-owned businesses will empower the black community is probably correct. It is a potential source of empowerment. It will not close the racial wealth gap. Okay. And this idea has been embraced historically by a diverse array of Americans, and they may be so diverse that it might give you reason to think that we should be nervous about it. Booker T. Washington, Marcus Garvey, Richard Nixon, and most recently by the hashtag Black Bank Movement. Now, from this perspective, I'm sorry?
That would be me.
That would be you? All right, here we go. We will have a conversation today, I suspect. All right. Okay. From this perspective, if only black consumers would invest in their own communities, turning inward for solutions to their economic woes, rather than asking the state for a handout, and reparations is not a handout.
Right. Okay. Right.
They would become economically self-sufficient and eventually thrive. After all, the premise works as follows. Here's the argument. A group with a low profile of achievement does not have to persuade members of the dominant group to embrace policies to repair the outgroup that may impose costs on the dominant group. Everything ultimately can be solved internally with the right amount of spit and polish. Okay? That's the perspective. In 1968, the same year that King called for a bank-in, none other than presidential hopeful Richard Nixon came out endorsing black capitalism. Okay. In his speech to the Republican National Convention, Nixon proclaimed, "Instead of government jobs and government housing and government welfare, let government use its tax and credit policies to enlist in this battle against poverty, the greatest engine of progress ever developed in the history of man, American private enterprise." Okay, so the subtext here, I'm a socialist. Okay, go ahead. So black capitalism in Nixon's eyes was the solution. So while white America received ample government support through public policies to build and maintain wealth, black Americans were offered a deficient private sector strategy. Black capitalism was a solution that would allow the government to hand over the economic problems of poverty and insufficient wealth in the black community to the community itself, effectively ridding the government of responsibility. But black businesses and banks cannot thrive on a separate and unequal playing field. For instance, in the United States, black banks are smaller and less profitable than similar white institutions. This is not because the black institutions lack a strong business model or viable leaders, but because of the economic situation of the communities where they operate and their own disparate levels of access to startup and developmental finance. For instance, since black families have minimal liquid wealth, and by liquid wealth I mean the portion of your net worth that you can convert into dollars to use immediately, since black family, and the typical black family in the United States has about $200 in liquid wealth, okay? Typical white family has in excess of $10,000 in liquid wealth, okay? So since black families have minimal liquid wealth, their bank accounts tend to hold money for day-to-day and week-to-week expenses. Small and unstable deposits due to continued economic penalties forced upon black workers and households makes profitability a significant challenge for banks that attempt to serve them. In the end, if black banks and businesses are a solution to the racial wealth gap, we must address a basic math problem that arises. To close the gap, black banks and enterprises must earn a much higher rate of return than white businesses. Without this condition being met, the gap only will be perpetuated rather than ended. So what is the state of black enterprise in the United States today? A recent report by the Association for Enterprise Opportunity indicates that 2.58 million U.S. black-owned businesses only generate $150 billion in revenue. Okay? I want that to sink in. You take all of the black-owned enterprises in the United States and they generate $150 billion in revenue. I'm going to show you how small that is relative to other activities in this society. For instance, in 2016, the top 100 black-owned firms identified by Black Enterprise collectively grossed $24 billion and employed 73,940 workers. In contrast, Walmart, the top firm by revenue in the United States, grossed more than 20 times as much in revenue and employed 2.2 million more workers than the entire top 100 black-owned firms combined in the same year. In fact, Walmart, which is the largest private employer in the United States, generates more revenue than all of the 2.58 million black-owned businesses combined. Okay? So when we're talking about small business, we're talking about small. Okay? Black-owned banks also are minuscule in the context of the general scale of American banking. The largest five black-owned banks recently were estimated to have assets totaling $2.3 billion, while J.P. Morgan Chase alone has an estimated $2 trillion in assets. So the top five black banks' assets were only a tiny 0.1% of Morgan's assets. Wow. This indicates that the existing infrastructure of black-owned banks lacks the capacity to produce wide and substantial increases in black wealth. Even if they were to double, triple, or quadruple their assets, black banks would not be major players on the American economic landscape, never mind the global landscape. Moreover, since black wealth is so low in the first place, it is a mere fantasy to anticipate that the existing black consumer base could build a black-owned equivalent of J.P. Morgan by banking black with our current resources. Okay. Indeed, the illusion that blacks have the capacity to build a separate major economy is perpetuated by the frequently repeated observation that black Americans possess, and you've heard this one, $1.2 trillion in buying power. Okay, and so far we've spent it badly, I guess. Okay, Jared Ball has advanced the following potent destruction of this contemporary cliche. First, the claim that black America has roughly $1 trillion in buying power is popularly repeated mythology with no basis in sound economic logic or data. While the myth has a longer history, it is today largely propelled by misreadings and poor or false interpretations of Nielsen surveys and marketing reports. Second, buying power is a marketing phrase that refers only to the power of consumers to purchase what are strictly available goods and is used as a measurement for corporations for better marketing their products. Power here has nothing to do with actual economic strength, and there is no collective $1 trillion that black people have and just foolishly spend ignorantly to their economic detriment. And finally, Ball says, the myth of buying power functions as propaganda, working to deny the reality of structural, intentional, and necessary economic inequality required to maintain society as it is, one that benefits an increasingly decreasing number of people. And even if we accept the estimated $1.2 trillion of black buying power as valid, still is only 60% of the value of J.P. Morgan's total assets. We don't have any money, and there's a reason why we don't. It's because of the history of this society. Okay. So now, I was in New Orleans. And I'm sitting in a cab, and I had given a talk on reparations, and the cab driver, who was a black man, asked me about what I had been talking about, and I said reparations, and he said, we don't need that. He said, look, he was involved in a project where they were trying to get each of the nations, I assume they mean every black American, including children, but if not, it's going to make the numbers look even worse that I'm about to talk about. But let's say they want the nation's 40 million black Americans to contribute $10 a month into a fund, and that's going to be the foundation for developing a successful world of black enterprises. So $10 a month, I don't know. Have any of you heard this $10 a month scheme?
Yeah. Okay.
So $10 a month is $120 a year, right? Okay. The typical family in the United States, black or white, cannot cover an additional $400 in expenses without probably having to go into debt. Okay. So $120 a year doesn't sound like it's huge, but it's not entirely trivial. And the idea here is that this fund would support black-owned banks who in turn would finance further development of black-owned businesses. But I ran the numbers. The total amount of that fund would come to $4.8 billion. And this is a tiny speck in America's overall wealth and national income. In fact, it's virtually invisible. Okay. The key to assisting black businesses in their development and growth lies in leveling the terrain of racial wealth differences and increasing black entree to startup and developmental capital in the first place. Prior research has confirmed that individuals with access to family wealth, both directly through transfers from immediate family members or indirectly through kin networks, have markedly higher rates of entrepreneurship and are more likely to start larger businesses. More than two decades ago, Timothy Bates found that individuals with relatively high levels of education, this is two decades ago, and at least $100,000 in net worth were the persons most likely to undertake self-employment. But today, the median black household's net worth is one-tenth of the threshold figure for successful entry advanced by Bates in 1995. And if you were to do a present value calculation on that sum to the present, you're getting closer to a $300,000 threshold. Okay? While some may argue that the wealthy tend to make better entrepreneurs, Evans and Jovanovich argue strongly that the data reject this explanation, and that the levels of capital required to start businesses systematically exclude non-wealthy individuals, regardless of their degree of entrepreneurial talent. So with the denial of black wealth accumulation, and with the continued exclusion of blacks from business credit markets, blacks simply do not have access to the necessary resources to build corporations that can be players in a global economy. A black American corporate monolith cannot be built on $1.2 trillion in spending capacity, never mind $4.8 billion in seed capital. Mirza Baradaran, in her recent book, on the history of black banks forcefully argues that buying black, banking black is a stance that is symptomatic of an attraction to a dream, a false dream of black capitalism. She contends that, again, in the absence of a wide, deep, and independent foundation in wealth among all black Americans, the prospect of a world of giant black-owned corporations is no more than a fantasy. Baradaran's central conclusion is capitalism, whether black or white, cannot fix problems created by racialized public policies. So we have. I want to make it clear that I have no objection to banking black or buying black. In the interest of black solidarity, the idea has tremendous merit. But the failure to bank black or buy black does not explain why we have a racial wealth gap of this magnitude, nor will banking black or buying black do much to reduce that gap.
Mm.